We'll do a roll call. I'm Jonah Schwartz.
Anyone else want
to? So do we take turns, or do you call our names and we say here? What's the drill here?
Oh, okay. Well, I was waiting for people just to respond. But
well, I couldn't see anybody's hands, so, you know.
Okay. Jim?
I'm here. Jim Hansen.
Okay. Mike?
Here, sir.
Okay. And Paige?
Paige Galloway is here.
Very good. Okay. So, the next item on the agenda is
we got one more. Who's there?
Hey, it's Jean Langendorf.
Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Oh, did we get another one?
This is Mark Gold.
Hey, Mark.
Well, hello, Mr. Gold.
Hi, I'm on my way to Washington, so it's an airport phone call.
Okay. All right. So on the call we have Jim Hennepy, Paige McGillway, Mike Goodwin, Jean Langendorf, Mark Gold, and then Ashley Schweikart, and
Marshall Mitchell and Elizabeth Yevich.
Thank you. So that's everyone that's on the call. Thank you all for joining this morning. Our next item on the agenda is the approval of the March 2nd meeting minutes, which were attached in the email that Ashley sent. So is there any discussion about the March 2nd meeting minutes?
I would make a motion that we accept them as presented.
Thank you. We've got a motion on the table. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, we got a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay, hearing none, we're ready to vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you very much.
Oh, someone else get on? Anyone else there? Oh, I guess I'm hearing things.
Okay. So the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay. Our goal this morning is to talk about Chapter 3 of the biennial plan. And Ashley, do you want to take it from here?
Sure. As you know, at the March 2nd committee meeting, during our approval of the definition of service-enriched housing that went to the TDHCA's governing board to be possibly adopted as a rule, we talked a lot about what other things we would want to have in our biennial plan that support this definition, so additional terminology or maybe further explanation of the language that was used in the definition of service-enriched housing. So the handout that I created and was sent to all of you electronically basically is just a quick rundown of the topics which through our March 2nd meeting I decided to include within this chapter, and I think that it would be great if we could maybe take them topic by topic and, you know, have a little bit of discussion on each one and hopefully make some decisions about what's going to be the text, the language of this chapter. So I wanted to reiterate something that Brooke, who unfortunately couldn't be here, but she had mentioned at the March 2nd meeting, which is that, you know, we want to make sure that we're not possibly limiting ourselves through adding more restrictive definitions than is necessary, so that we, you know, we don't want to limit potential funding sources or things like that. So, but with that said, the first topic that I had on the discussion handout was elderly. I know that in the very first report that staff gave to the council back in November, We had offered three possible definitions of elderly, and there was some discussion, I think, at each meeting since then about, you know, where we want to go with choosing a definition on that. So is there a discussion that we want to talk about there?
This is Jean. I just like the broadest definition. So can you tell me which of these has the broadest reach?
I believe that the Administration on Aging that uses the Older Americans Act definition, that definition is, please correct me if I'm wrong, is 62?
No. The Administration on Aging and the Texas Human Resource Code both have the same definition, and that's 60-plus.
60-plus, okay. I believe that that one is the broadest. Can anyone confirm or deny that?
Well, I mean, from TDHC, from HUD, is that 62 or 65? So
I believe that HUD is 62.
62.
So 60-plus would be more broad.
Right, 60-plus is more broad. But again, the Administration on Aging and Texas's own definition.
Those two definitions, in my opinion, this is my good one, would be best for our purposes because most of the agencies are used to using the Texas definitions to begin with.
That's what I was thinking, too.
And only if you're going to be using some sort of HUD program would that 62 restriction come in there. And in all honesty, you could probably get a waiver on it by saying, well, you know, the funding that we have on the other side is less, and we'll go to near elderly defined as 60. HUD defines near elderly as 65, but I don't see a problem getting a waiver if we ever ran into that restriction.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think we might as well go for the 60-plus, and if there's any problems with HUD, it's part of our task is to identify barriers to in the regulation. So if that were to come to play, that would restrict it, but let's go with Texas's definition and the federal definition, and the Administration on Aging definition.
All right. So I think that's pretty well agreed upon. Is there anything else that we want to discuss in terms of any type of anecdotal, qualitative data, or if we can find some quantitative data on the need for service rooms housing for this population that anyone in the council can point to and perhaps staff can compile and analyze that data and include it in this chapter?
Yeah, the thing actually that I would suggest, I don't know if you've done this or not, and I can certainly help do this for you, is ask whether or not the Administration of Aging has data like this. For some reason, I believe they do, or AARP, or even the National Council of State Independent Living, they may have this data. I'm not saying they do have it, but they may, but I'll be glad to ask those organizations if they've got it.
Okay, Mark, would you, if you'd be willing to kind of reach out to any contacts that you
have? Sure.
That'd be great.
Yeah, and I'm going to a meeting in Washington right now with CMS and all that, and I'll ask around when I'm up there, too, about what's going on. There's a triple, the Administration on Aging is going to be at this meeting where I'm talking. So
Mark,
I'll do that.
This is Jean. A couple of years ago, they did a pretty extensive report on housing for people here in Texas, it was under the AAA. I thought Dad did it with a consultant.
Yeah, Jean, for some reason, it sticks in my mind, too. So,
yeah.
I will ask our AAA division, and I'll ask up here and see what I'll do. But I believe you're right. Because when I was reading the report, that was one of the things that sort of stuck in my mind when I saw that. I said, I'm sure there's some study someplace, somewhere that's described the housing needs. So.
Remember Dr. Salvi, or I think that was her last name, used to work over at the Ministry on Aging or whatever at Dad's, or when it was on its own somewhere else, I don't know. But and then she went to DD Council. But prior to that, if I'm not mistaken, I mean now she's left the state, but she had been kind of the lead investigator on that report. It may be a good six years old.
Yeah, I'll start with that. And even Carl Urban now, with the Department of Family and Protective Services, he's with TVOA, and he was a researcher. So
yeah.
Between all these contacts, if there is something out there, I'll help find it.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And didn't AARP recently do a study on housing? Or did
I believe that's right, Jonas, and that's why I'm saying AARP. And I'll ask Amanda Fredrickson if she has anything, or even Susan Reinhardt, who I know up in Washington, what they've got. So I'll just send a general email out to people. I know there's something out there.
Okay, great. Are there any additional resources that anyone can think of that we should add to this list?
Are we going to look at sort of need by age category? Because obviously a lot of this stuff kind of cross-pollinates. You've got elderly and then folks with disabilities, which will overlap, and then, of course, the income issue. So are we sort of just kind of looking to get a cursory look at need at this point, or what?
Well, what I can do in my thing is I have contacts with the associations with individuals with disabilities also, and also within DAD. We have sort of a little research area there. So I'll just ask for all information across age.
Okay.
Ashley, I have a comment. This is Paige.
Okay.
I just wanted to bring up that I know that for a qualified elderly development or tax credit, it can go down to 55, and so I don't know if we need to bring that up or not, or if we care. Age 55.
So isn't, you know, I don't know the exact language, but it's either a certain percentage, 55 and older, or a certain percentage, 62 and older, is that correct?
Yeah, 80% of the units have to be occupied by a person by 55 or older.
Okay.
I mean, maybe you could have a caveat in how you say, I mean, have the two definitions of what we prefer, but say, you know how later on in some of the documents you provided, let the programs dictate, you know, what is acceptable or required, and maybe we could have some type of language, or as otherwise, you know, defined by program requirements or something. I don't know. But
yeah, that seems logical.
Yeah. Yeah, so as defined by program requirements. Okay. I think that makes sense. All right. Great. All right, so can we go on to then our definitions of disability then? I think that there was also some, there is the Americans with Disabilities Act definition, there is the HUD definition, there's the Social Security Administration definition. I think that I included these three because I think that they're used most frequently in terms of funding sources at the federal level and programs and funding sources. So I just wanted to see what people's ideas were. I mean, I know that I think we're probably going to go with however we can be most broad, but I think this is a little bit different than the elderly in terms of setting an age because it's more about we don't want to limit ourselves into what types of disabilities we're including. So any thoughts on these definitions?
Isn't the Americans with Disabilities Act the broadest?
Yeah, I would say ADA is probably the broadest.
Yeah, it is.
Even with the amendment to the FISA card.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that should be the titanium standard, the ADA, I would draw on. So.
Yeah, I agree.
This is Marshall, but the regarded as and record of part of the ADA definition probably wouldn't apply because they wouldn't necessarily need services because they don't now actively have a disability. That's more for discrimination purposes. Wouldn't it more be the first part, the A part we're talking about?
We're just using it as a definition to sort of broadly describe what the population is. We're not doing it for saying that everyone who's covering that population needs our services. We're just saying if someone falls under that definition and we have services offered, they would be the target population.
And I know on your third page of this, there's something about a member recommends using the HUD definition, which I'm kind of surprised, but because HUD is a lot more restrictive. But I don't know if it's, obviously it may not be a member who's on this committee.
Yeah, this was any feedback I received from the entire council.
Okay.
And I want to make sure I know that there was some discussion at the full council meeting on March 2nd about making sure that we include additional language further than just what definition that we are adopting as a council, to make sure that we state the inclusion of persons with mental illnesses and substance abuse disorders. So I don't know if there is kind of a way that we want to.
Well, did you intend to use the ADA, to write out the ADA definition or what? Because we would include, that would be pretty clear. Obviously,
yeah.
People with mental illness, there's no question.
Yeah.
So,
and
go ahead. Sorry.
This is Jonas, and that definition is also inclusive of people who have a substance abuse disability as long as at the time they apply for services, they are in some kind of a treatment or support program.
Okay. All right.
Well, that could be kind of problematic because it's almost like a catch-22. We're trying to offer service-rich housing, and they're trying to get into those into the housing. So we certainly want to include substance abuse. And I don't know if we need it as a we adopt like the ADA definition, and we also include substance abuse, individuals with substance abuse.
I just wanted to make sure because I know that Nick Doster had mentioned that I think that DSHS, I think that they are very. I received feedback that he had actually sent our the plan outline to a couple of members of the various divisions within DSHS, and they too were very adamant that there be some statement of inclusion of that population. I think simply just because a lot of times they're not included, and that people just either assume that they are there, assume that they aren't there, and I think maybe he just wanted to make sure we were specific.
Well, and then I would want to be very specific too because I have a program with State Health Services. We're doing a pilot in San Antonio on substance abuse and individuals who are older and with disability. And so it's a major, major problem, and we certainly need to make sure that that's included. It's a huge problem across the state.
So is there any type of any ideas for what kind of language maybe would go after the ADA definition that would just be supplementary about persons with mental illness?
Mental illness would be included. I don't think
that's part of it.
Going to be an issue. I think you're talking about those that might be excluded in the ADA definition, and it may be good, Ashley, to write that out. What you're referring to as the ADA definition, and I think then we might be able to say if we want to amend that to include those that are current substance abuse users.
Right, who have been clinically identified as having issues regarding substance abuse.
Yeah.
This is my good one. My take on this is we don't have to say what agency's definition we're doing. We just write the definition. So
correct. That's what I'm saying. If she takes the ADA definition, puts that out of
what we want to add.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we'll see, because we're all probably thinking a little bit different, or we have different views of what we would say the ADA definition is. So I'm assuming, Ashley, you have something that you were referring to then, and if we can see that, then of that, or Marshall, then we would make an amendment to say, for purposes, again, using our for purposes of directing the work, we also are including those, as Mark just said, very nicely, Mark, so if you can pen that would be good.
Yeah.
Those that are, currently.
To clinically identified.
There you go.
Okay. So can I make a suggestion of using her phrase for the purposes of and without reference to the ADA, we say for the purposes of the council or
right.
word that the term disability shall mean.
Yeah, and just use and it would be closely aligned with the definition.
And that way you're not letting someone reinterpret because I know more about what an ADA says than you know more. But we've said for our purposes, here's what it is, folks. Don't go searching elsewhere.
I would want to, being the cynic, I would want to make sure that whatever we put down as closely matches that as possible because, at some point somebody's going to question or appeal something. And I figure the closer you are to some statute, the better.
Well, no doubt if you include every element of the ADA definition, you're essentially in a safe harbor, but if you add something to be more inclusive, I don't think someone would sue you for going further than the ADA strict definition requires. They will sue you for going short, but never for going long.
Right.
So by like I say, if we don't say we're using the ADA definition plus to say for the purpose of our council, here's what it is, I think you've created a safe harbor under ADA. And added what the committee feels is necessary to bring in that expanded population we're concerned about.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. I think that we kind of already went over that Mark is going to, within DAD, see what kind of qualitative or quantitative data we have available about service-enriched housing needs for this population. So we'll move forward with that. I also think that, it will be helpful to partner with DISHES to find out what kind of qualitative and quantitative data we can grab from them about persons with mental illness and substance abuse disorders. So,
yeah, and they have all that information, and it's interesting, too, because the state's piloting a test right now about including substance abuse as a Medicaid state plan. So I'm sure that they have data on what they think the scope of the problem is.
Okay.
All
right. I think we should go on to the next topic, which was homelessness. There was some feedback from various council members about how we approach homelessness as a section of this chapter, since it's not directly stated in the definition. I know there was a comment to create maybe a subsection of the chapter about target populations. I don't know how people feel about that or how people want to approach that special needs population in this chapter.
So let me ask a rhetorical question here. If we're going to make sure that we're including populations with mental illness and who may have a substance abuse, and I realize that not every individual homeless has those sort of issues, but that's the sort of population, even within the homeless population, we're trying to target. Wouldn't those sort of disability definition sort of then include people if we say regardless of residence? I mean, we're not going to tie the disability definition to whether or not you have a residence or not.
I agree with you, Mark.
I
don't think we need to. I mean, I know everybody has said, yeah, we heard issues of homelessness, but it's really the populations that we're talking about, and they really are counted. There are, there is the, well, which you all serve on, there is an effort to address the homeless as a grouping that I really think our focus needs to be on elderly and disability, which disability would include people that are struggling with homelessness due to their disability.
Yeah, I think we should keep it to that definition. Again, we're including things. We're not saying you have to have a house, you have to have a residence to receive services. That's the whole point of the service from 1,000. I think we're including that population, personally. As long as we make sure we're including substance abuse in our definition of disability.
I agree.
Well, I think one of the questions of homelessness was what Ashley termed putting it in the next step category. What about those persons who are homeless, who are neither elderly nor disabled, but some sort of service-enriched housing might take them out of the homeless category? That's where you get into lifestyle, self-sufficiency, educational, and that kind of stuff. There's a huge population out there, you know, at that. And we're going to find out here in San Antonio because we're conducting a roundup of homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
We're herding them into a single facility.
Well, I think that part of the reason why it was necessary to bring up this topic was because at the March 2nd committee meeting, as you guys recall, and it's in your meeting minutes, there was a discussion of, I think that you know, and I don't want to speak on behalf of committee members that aren't here, but I think that there were some committee members not present right now that had brought it up about, you know, perhaps maybe talking about the co-occurrence that many times happens between persons who are homeless and having a disability or having problems with substance abuse. And I don't know if we don't want to have language like about co-occurrence in there. I mean, maybe it'll come out in the data that we collect.
Won't there be a section in Norfolk that describes or gives some examples of some of the situations that people who could benefit from service-enriched housing might encounter?
We can do that. I think that's kind of the purpose of bringing this up, is to say, what do you guys want to see? And if it's not meant for this chapter, where do you want to put it?
Well, I mean, I think we need, and other members, please jump in, but I mean, I think we need a place in the report where we give some examples of who we're talking about in terms of service and rich housing, and maybe the best text to put that in would be when we're describing or giving a summary of the public forums that we held. Because, you know, that's where we heard the examples for individuals who were homeless.
Yeah, perhaps something like that, like an addendum, where you would have those sort of, and I agree with you, Jonas, an addendum with a, you know, examples of both service-enriched housing and populations, you know, and maybe some profiles of what some of these individuals would look like.
I can definitely draw from the transcripts we have of the public forums and put that into a section that we can decide if we want it to be in more of an appendix form or if we want it to actually be a main piece of the chapter on the public forums.
And my point is, I think you make a statement in that chapter that certainly, you know, the profiles, I like that idea, the profiles stated in this report would be individuals who would benefit from service-enriched housing.
And this is my gut. Somewhere in our deliberations, the back of my brain says we talked about purpose of the program, and one of the things that we kept coming back to is to allow aging in place or to allow them to remain in an independent living as long as possible before going to a full-service facility. And that, if we have that type of discussion in a preamble or a lead-in, I think that would be a great place to caveat it and say, however, we know that there is a significant population in the homeless category who also can benefit from this program because, in addition to homeless, they are persons who are elderly or who have disabilities that might be contributing to the homeless, so the goal would be to seek them out and move them into a service and rich housing environment.
You know, this is Jim. There's a couple thoughts on that. Number one, I agree with the notion of people transitioning internally. Back in the 90s, early 90s, we started doing what was then called supported housing. That was the principle, is every time somebody advanced in a skill level or their needs reduced, they had to move, and vice versa. And I also think that if we think of just and you may not want to do this, but I think in terms of what's out there and what's being focused on versus what's not. And folks who are homeless, who are just homeless, very often have access to things. Folks who are homeless and mentally ill or homeless and have substance abuse or homeless, mentally ill and have substance abuse or a developmental disability tend not to fit into anything that exists and they're in terms of what resources there are. And so, in my brain, I'm thinking that if we become too generic too fast, we're just going to really limit our capacity to do anything.
Okay. Are there any other thoughts about how we address this? I from what I've heard, it sounds like that we, in order to address the different populations that we are looking to have under this umbrella of service and rich housing, to use the profiles, as we're going to call them, from the public forum transcripts to give examples of persons who would benefit from a service and rich housing program or model or whatever it becomes. And I think that one point that Mike brought up that maybe we do need to discuss is, are we going to be creating some type of preamble, as he put it, or some type of statement of this?
Well, I think that's always kind of helpful. I know for the Promoting Independence reports, we always have what we call a preface. And the preface is sort of a general statement of what the report is all about and what we're trying to do. It's not a long section. It's usually maybe one page. But it seems to work well to sort of set the tone for the rest of the report. So that's just a recommendation.
Other thoughts?
I really think that's a good strategy to use because you set the tone for the reader right away.
Yeah. I mean, it's done in sort of a general, large, global vision sense versus then the report gets into the nitty-gritty, but it sort of really does, it works very well for us in TI.
And then we can have our definition of homeless in our definition category, so we've brought them in at the front and we've set what we consider it to be for the program.
Right.
Sorry, wait a minute. Sorry, I guess I need some clarification now. So in terms of this preface, as Mark was saying, it can be at a more broad level of the intentions of the report and the reasons behind the creation of the report. We're not getting into definitions in this preface.
No.
Okay.
No.
Verify that.
No. I mean, that's just within the body. I mean, actually, like in a preface, it's a global vision, and it sort of sets the tone and the philosophy for what the report's going to be here. So get into the nitty-gritty and the definition.
Okay. I just want to make sure we have that clarified. Okay. So going back to Chapter 3, I think that we had some discussion on the March 2nd committee meeting about accessibility, and I wanted to know kind of how we want to approach that. I think that we discussed maybe making sure that we talk about accessibility for those that have mobility impairments versus non-mobility related disabilities, and also talking about, you know, what our definitions for adaptable or visible are going to include.
And I'm just curious, Ashley, have you looked at, and I know these may be similar but different issues, but have you also looked at the Texas Accessibility Barriers Act that the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulatory administer?
I don't know if I have looked and that through that department.
Okay. I mean, you may want to just look as an adjunct to the way Texas is doing its version of architectural barriers and accessibility.
It's called the Texas Accessibility Standards.
Thank you. I knew the word accessibility was.
And they mimic much of the federal, but it might, being that we're trying to tie a lot of this to Texas law, it might be a good thing for us to reference that.
Yeah, I mean, at least reference, or at least certainly look at it and see what that has to offer. I mean, I think it would be remiss as an interagency, an interorganizational council, not to look at Texas's own standards. So.
Well, and these are what TDRL reviews any of the multifamily.
That's right.
Properties that TDHCA does. So.
We'll be sort of a little safe for ground here.
Yeah.
It's really an area that we need to look at, even if when we talk about other barriers to this whole process. We at least need to be familiar with those standards.
Okay. I will definitely look into that. Because I haven't looked at it, so you guys can tell me, but I didn't know if there was anything that we wanted to state about properties being visitable or adaptable.
Well, you would be referring to visitable in the event you were talking about single family. Otherwise, you're covered under TDRL or under anything that's covered in a multifamily, so there is, or fair housing. There's really a difference in why we use the word visitable, because there's no standards for single family. What the state has passed is visitability, basically through Senate Bill 623 from way back, was adopting visitability standards for single family, that which is not covered by fair housing. So we may want to reference the state standards on that, and you all don't have those standards listed here. But I know you, if I could grab some of my other documents, you all, TDHCA refers to them a lot in their funding when it comes to any single family.
Okay.
That the state would put money into. So I think those two together might get to where we want to be as far as our standards go.
Is the consensus or the thinking here that we're looking, and because I'm not familiar with the standards, are they standards of physical accessibility?
Sure.
And are we limiting the scope of what we're doing for a number of folks who might be served?
Are you talking about, like, flashing alarms or something that, not necessarily that it's mobility that we're also looking at?
Well, somebody with a mental illness or somebody with a developmental disability or somebody, you know, who wouldn't necessarily require architectural issues.
Right.
Or are we saying anything that qualifies under this must meet all the architectural standards?
Well, any new construction would anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's state laws that...
Right, anything new. But I was wondering, you know, about, again, in other programs, looking at general housing stock in the community and making use of that for certain populations of folks, you know, may be a benefit. So I didn't know.
And generally these standards... as long as if it's not new construction, they're basically exempt from, you know, unless they're doing substantial modifications. So I think the requirements that are under these referencing laws would not restrict utilizing current housing if you weren't modifying it. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
So it wouldn't limit the use of existing homes.
Okay.
Yeah, because each of these definitions are specific about which situation you're in, whether it's new construction or whether you're modifying something.
And Jean, the Fair Housing Act only covers 4 units or above.
Correct.
Disability covers single family.
No, less than 4. It's the gap.
Okay, it does think the gap.
Then. Yeah, it does duplexes and fourplexes.
All right.
Okay.
If we're going to go that route, I would like it to be fairly specific to cover exemptions, because multifamily housing constructed prior to 1991 is essentially exempt from the fair housing requirements. But if we don't say that in relation to this program and we just say it must be accessible, then many of those have been retrofitted with some mobility accessible units, and all would require an allowance for a sight or hearing impaired modification, but they're not all going to have 3-0 doors and turning radiuses and all that kind of stuff, and not necessarily have the mobility accessible route through the property, and I would hate to exclude those properties from servicing populations that don't need the mobility modification.
What if we use also or somewhere in the mix the term reasonable accommodation, because that would cover it on an individual basis?
Well, and that would be the case if you're tying this to some of the standards. I mean, fair housing for sure, requires, if you're going to do any substantial rehab or anything, you know, that nature, that you're going to have to address some of those issues. But as far as even with utilizing 504, if you're doing a modification, you're going to do it as accessible as you can get it, basically. So I think if we look at those standards, and that's kind of, I think once they're written out, we'll be better able to make the kind of modifications or explanations that we need to do. But right now, with it just referring to 504 or something like that, and not having listed how that is printed, it's kind of hard for us to have this discussion.
Okay. Well, I had looked at the federal level accessibility standards, but I will look at the Texas accessibility standard that TDRL uses. I will look at basically any other. I think that Jean, you mentioned SB 623,
mm-hmm.
And that
it's now. I mean, it's codified. You all have it in your code. I mean, you refer to it like.
Right.
Definitely in all of your RFPs and stuff like that.
Right, right. Okay, I will print that all out, type that all out so you guys can read it and decide whether or not those different pieces of policy are sufficient for this section.
That'd be great. I think once we see these things as paragraphs or as, you know, with the words that we're reviewing, we'll be able to address this a lot.
Okay.
Better.
Yeah, I think that part of the problem we're having and the problem I had when we first started working with definitions and all that, in that if we try to be inclusive about every possible accessibility that we can do, you know, we're going to leave something out. And that's why I was thinking, if we're doing it the route like they did in the ADA with reasonable accommodation, somehow word that in there somehow, then it would be whoever is participating in the service and housing and meets the definition of disability, you know, somehow another accessibility would be based on their needs. As you were saying earlier, it might be flashing lights, it might be a ramp, it might be something totally different. And you don't want to restrict it to say every unit has to have all of these specific things.
Okay.
Yeah, but I agree with Jean. We have to lay this all out, look at it, and then see what the, like the unintended consequences are and what the consequences are. This is an opportunity to go forward in time, not backward in time.
Great.
Okay.
The next topic that I had for this discussion was integration, and I know that that the staff had done the PowerPoint on TDHCA's integrated housing rule and the definition that's used within the section on that rule. I'm not sure if we wanted to distinguish something about integration and, Brooke had mentioned, make sure that we distinguish what we're talking about when we say integration from other types of integration, such as, racial integration and housing and things like that.
Well, I understand the TAC title, because I've worked with it. I don't know that everybody else on this phone call does, but I don't, truthfully, off the top of my head, and others may know the section 12182 of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Again, if I could see those side by side, I could probably do a better job of telling you what I think.
Sure, yeah, sorry. It's in the plan outline. I just gave the summary for the handout.
Oh, okay.
I included the full definitions in the outline, I'm pretty sure.
Do you know what page? Because I've got
I might grab it.
It's page 9 of 26, I think, integration.
Page 9?
Mm-hmm.
No, but again, if we're talking about a Texas program, the TAC 10 is the one that's going to be more familiar, and I don't think it is more restrictive than the ADA.
Well, the ADA really doesn't, it talks about integrated settings, which is not a housing term.
And it doesn't talk about integration. It doesn't really refer to that.
Yeah, it's more integrated. It's a different. So I really think the TAC is the one we want.
Yeah, the TAC is the one we want.
No, without question. That is exactly what we want.
Okay. Is there anything else that we wanted to add to any discussion of integration in this chapter? Besides having the definition?
No, because I think the other definitions that we've already determined we're going to use address that issue.
Okay. Good.
I agree with you on that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, and then... Yeah, so I think that this is also a definite discussion point at our March 2nd committee meeting about independence and how we are going to word language on independence. I wonder what kind of housing models we are going to be discussing, if we are going to be discussing any in this chapter.
I don't think independence in our definition is a term that needs to be defined.
Yeah.
I don't.
What does that add? What are we doing? Everything we're doing is supposed to be helping to promote an individual's independence.
Yeah. We're not talking about a model when we say foster independence in living.
Right.
And the way I read our definition, it wasn't something I felt needed to be. We didn't have to define what we meant by independence.
Yeah, it's very self-explanatory in the context of the definition itself.
Yeah,
it's not a housing model. It's a goal we're trying to get to.
I think that can go into the preface where you're saying, part of what we're doing is helping to promote individuals' independence in order to have a high quality of life. That's the overall goal and mission. Of self-enriched housing is to provide those opportunities so people can feel more independent. But it's a subtext. It's not what we're doing.
It's not an absolute. It's just kind of it's a process.
And independence is probably different for every individual.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, so then I think that the next topic is affordability, and this was really briefly mentioned on March 2nd, but we didn't really get into it much about what if we're going to put any language in here about affordability, expanding on what we said in the definition.
I think affordability is defined by the program under which the service is provided. And, for example, if you're talking of, we'll say, HUD housing with direct rental assistance, the term affordability sometime back in ancient times went as high as 95% of AMI, but both through the Housing Authority and HUD itself, those numbers have been driven down to 30%. So there's a huge population in need of housing that is going to be excluded because the vouchers and the Section 8 slots are in general only going to those at 30% or less of AMI.
My concern, and it always has been, because I work with Medicaid primarily, is that people at 17% to 20% is AMI are the ones who are going to need and have desperate need for housing. And so my question is more philosophical, is are we going to be all things to all people at all times, or are we going to be focused just on a particular part? And I don't know what the answer is. I just hate to see people who are really in desperate straits for both services and housing be sort of thrown at the bottom of the barrel yet again.
You know, I like the portion of the TDHA definition that just starts housing where the occupant is paying no more than 30% of their gross income for gross housing costs, including utilities costs. End of discussion. I mean, that really gets to a person, based on a person's income, if you're paying less than 30%, which is the HUD way of figuring, like our 811 projects, they never pay more than 30% of their income. That addresses no matter what income you're at, it's going to be affordable to the individual. So those who really only make, you know, $600 a month, they're not going to pay more than 30% of their income.
Well, I think that's a great compromise, Jim. I really do. I think that at least starts approaching the question. And I think, too, we have to remember, this is a biennial plan that's going to be updated, correct?
Yep.
Okay, so we can start off this way. If we're finding that we have other needs and more needs, then we'll be amending this document as time goes on.
Yep. I think a lot of the groups I work with in affordable housing, I mean, feel comfortable in that 30%, because then you're looking at the individual's income.
Yeah, that sounds like a great way of approaching it.
Okay.
Does that mean I qualify since my mortgage payment is less than 30% of my income?
you're a lucky man.
All right. Great. We will make sure we have that.
But we don't want to put any kind of income qualifier on it?
Well, you are.
No, you're not, because you're saying they're paying no more than 30%. That's what I'm saying. My mortgage payment is less than 30% of my income, which then means I qualify for service and rich housing.
No. We're talking about the housing. We're talking about affordability for the individual, that the housing that we're going to help create would be designed such that the residents would pay no more than 30%.
I think we're kind of stuck in between affordability and financial criteria. Because I'm hearing, you know, sort of, I agree wholeheartedly with the 30% on affordability, that we're saying, you know, that's the definition of affordable, is nobody pays more than 30%. And the other part of the discussion I'm hearing is that, you know, if I make $100,000 a year, am I eligible? And that's what I was hearing was your two different.
Yeah, that was just my question.
This clearly, you know, the statement about 30% clearly meets the, you know, in my opinion, the definition of affordable. It's a great way of saying it. But then we get to the other issue is financial eligibility, which is not on this sheet, but that's what you're raising, I believe.
But I will go back and buy off on her comment if we say housing, to be affordable housing, the cost of housing an individual pays can be no more than 30% of their gross income, including utilities.
Right, that defines affordable very well.
Yeah, I agree when it said that way. If we're restricting that only to the housing cost that an individual pays.
Okay.
So and that's what our definition says. Now, I may be looking at this incorrectly, but I think we're talking more about defined as integrated affordable, and affordable to us is going to be 30%, no more than 30% of their cost.
For rent and utilities.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Can I add a caveat on that? And I'm not going to say my name now because I don't want to be identified with this statement. There are properties that now would qualify, except in addition to your rent and your electricity, I'm going to charge you $30 a month to have a washer and dryer hooked up in your apartment. And that's neither rent nor utility. So do we say charges associated with the housing? Including, I'm just trying to make sure that
housing costs.
There's not hidden costs to the person that thinks they're only going to pay 30%, and all of a sudden, you know, there's $50 to $75 in add-ons for other things.
But it doesn't say rent; it says gross housing costs, and you could that perceived could be a housing cost. You could also say gross housing costs, including but not limited to utility costs.
Okay.
Okay.
That sounds good.
That's good.
Okay, yeah, I will.
But I think the way it's also stated is just fine. It says housing cost. It doesn't say rent.
Okay, that's fine. Right, I'm sorry.
Right.
I'll go back to sleep.
Okay. Then the next section is about service types and was referring to the part of the definition where we say health-related and other services and supports. I don't think we want to get incredibly specific here, but I think I was just trying to come up with some maybe groupings of services that we talk about. So I know this was mentioned at the full council meeting on March 2nd about medical services versus functional services, acute care versus long-term care, how people feel about that.
I think you probably need to maybe have some sort of opening statement, and it's pretty much alluded to here, that identifies that the first priority is to give that person or help that person access authority out there. And that this not be an effort to create something that, you know, to replace something that's already out there, then perhaps we can just kind of give a laundry list, because I do recall the debate regarding medical services, but we could say, you know, medical services and function and support services include but not limited to, and just kind of give a laundry list of sort of generic topics, you know, like housekeeping and home support and home training, transportation, so on and so forth, and, you know, access to, so, you know, we might want to look at that. But I think the main thing there is that we don't create the impression that this program is setting up, is providing, you know, supplanting what already exists, primarily in the medical area, but even in some of the functional, the training support area.
Well, I don't know what to even say about that. You know, a lot of the services that you're providing are functional supports. I mean, people and advocates for long-term services and supports, and for individuals with disabilities, and even for individuals who are older. You know, we're looking at not necessarily the doctor model. You know, we're looking at those supports that, like attendance supports to help in the activities of daily living, help in the activities of instrumental activities of daily living, to just get them through now, we're talking about service-enriched housing for individuals with mental illness. You know, there's going to be, again, some of the therapy, some of the group sessions, some of those supports. And some people would argue that those are functional supports versus medical supports, which would be, you know, the exact acute care sort of assistance people need. So, you know, I mean, the concern of doing a laundry list is, again, whether or not you're limiting or you use terms like such as, but I think this really goes to the heart of what is service housing.
I think that giving a laundry list, I'm not sure if that's going to be, further this goal that we have, because I feel like there could be something that would be left out, or it could be seen that we are prioritizing medical services, functional services, or vice versa. I'm not sure if we want to give a laundry list or if we want to just discuss what broader categories
right. We're
looking at.
Well, perhaps, we could maybe consider saying something, again, to the effect that it's not to supplant what exists out there, and define, you know, medical services as you know, a generic term, and, you know, functional services as those services that are specifically provided to assist the person to learn or maintain, you know, just a couple sentences that just broadly define what a support service is and what a medical service is, and leave it there.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is to either start it or end it that says that term will be defined by those supports the individual needs to reach the goals of the program. And that could be a doctor, it could be a wheelchair, it could be somebody to help them run their finances in order to maintain their independence and live in their housing.
That keeps us from the concern of creating a laundry list that might be either exclusive or perceived as prioritized.
I really feel it's important to at least maybe say in your categories, and I agree with you, laundry lists are very troublesome, but, you know, to help support, and use the terms activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily living. Those are real terms of art in the long-term services world, and I think those could be included.
I think the key here is to get the idea across that if it is not prohibited, you can try it, as opposed to saying, well, if it's not here, you can't do it.
Right. Are there any other thoughts, anything else about this? I had written questions about what are feasible in a community-based setting. Are there any limitations or restrictions to services based on ultimate models, funding sources used? But I think that kind of what I'm hearing from everyone is that we're going to try not to say what we think is feasible, but rather allow the services to be dictated by both what the individual is best for the individual to maintain independence, as well as what they can receive from the various programs and funding sources that are currently available in our right now.
Or may be available in the future.
Or may be available in the future. Okay.
I think based on the individual and based on the needs are really important. You captured that in your first kind of saying what you thought you were hearing from us.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. That was what was on my handout. I'm open to any additions to this chapter that we feel are necessary. Are there any additions to this discussion of further clarifying our definition and giving supporting terminology?
This is Mark, and goes back to one of the original discussions. And when we talk about service-enriched housing, again, I'm still confused what that means. Are we including those places that are licensed by the state? Or are we purely talking about single standing independent residences?
And I think that maybe it was just in the wrong place, but I think that that's kind of why I had those questions about housing models, and obviously I put them with attached to the wrong language, but that was a question that I wanted to bring up for this chapter.
I don't think we're talking about an institutionalized setting.
But institutionalized has a lot of different connotations. And again, you know, I mean, and I'm bringing this really up just for discussion. I'm not quite sure how I feel, but when you don't have, like, say, group homes, which serve three or four individuals included, those are real models of service and risk housing. Some of those are licensed. Some of them are contracted with the state. Now, assisted living, I do have a bias, and it does serve a real function in the society. This may not be the right place for it under what this council is trying to do, but those other sort of smaller group homes certainly are providing models of what I think of service and risk housing. So.
And you know, when Mark, when you say assisted living, there are assisted living facilities that have as part of their facility, independent cottages, and it's the aging in place concept, and when you can't keep up that, you might move to the apartment type situation, and then when that goes further south, you're into what I then call the institutionalized, which means you can't go anywhere else because you got to have everything that's there, and you don't have the ability to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
There are steps before you get there that are attached to assisted living that might very well qualify.
Yeah, well, and it's that, and it's like for our developmental disability population, they do live in small group home settings. We have adult foster care models that are, again, small group homes. Some of them are actually licensed as assisted living because of the statute under 247 Health and Safety Code that four or more individuals, so I mean, assisted living can be anything from a four-bed facility up to a 300-bed facility. There's a lot of definitions in between, so it's just, it's a complicated part, but I think it's really important, and it goes to when we'll be looking for models or be looking for funding, this is an important part of that conversation.
It is an important part of the conversation, but those, Mark, those kinds of housing options, they have a funding stream and they have a framework and regulations associated with those. So those are already available. What we're trying to do in this model, I think, is put, hopefully develop some housing that isn't currently available for individuals.
Well, when you say there's already a funding stream, there's a service funding stream. There's not necessarily a housing now. I mean, obviously, there's providers who find housing on dollars on their own. But, again, I'm just bringing this up for a conversation. I just want to make sure it's been well discussed. So as we move forward, we're very clear about what this is and what this is not.
This is Marshall. Isn't the word integrated in our... And they rule out a lot of places like group homes and assisted living units?
No, I mean, a group home, even a small ICFMR, which is, by definition, an institution, and yet it's only six beds, are houses in one's neighborhood. I had an ICFMR across the street from it. I mean, it was, it was integrated, obviously, in the community.
And you, know what I've said time and time again. If it's licensed, it's not housing. And that's true. I mean, and it would be excluded from housing funding. Generally, it's excluded from housing funding.
has a license.
Are you talking about like the IRS rules on housing tax credits and things like that?
Well, some of that, but I mean, as far as if you're looking at licensing a facility, I know they're small facilities. I'm not debating that they're not small facilities, but because of the nature of what they are, they are licensed as facilities. Do you know? I mean, you all call them facilities. It's a facility license, right, Mark?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. But I just need to put on the record as the representative from DAD that we do that. We're excluding a large part of the population that we serve at DAD. Not everyone, but there'll be a large part of the population that will be excluded.
And I mean, Mark, explain what you mean by excluded.
Well, by definition, that they receive their services either in assisted living or a group home setting or self-foster care, that by definition, they wouldn't be included if they have either a license or a sort of contract with the state. And again, I'm not saying we should go the route of not including institutional settings. I just want to make sure we're not having a rush to judgment here and that we're having a full conversation so we really do understand who we're really targeting. That's all.
So can I ask another further conversation here just to explain a little bit more, Mark? So is it through the nature of, say, the Medicaid waiver that the regulation, the rules of that waiver dictate that the services must be received in an assisted living facility? Is that what you're saying?
It's not a waiver.
No, it's a choice. People have a choice where they want to live, and if they can find housing. I mean, that's part of the problem. Sometimes housing is not available, and so assisted living is there. We have certain restrictions on what that assisted living must look like. It looks like an apartment-type setting. I mean, it's really in some assisted living facilities, they look no different than what I think I've heard you say an SRO looks like. It's an apartment, it's a some kitchen, its own, all that. But there's a lot of people, especially in our developmental disability population, who choose a small group home that's called a residential model, and that is a 3-to-4-bed home.
Mark Goodwin, let me ask a question. I think we're either bifurcating or trying to be too strict in what we're talking about. If we're talking about service-enriched housing, we're talking about developing housing that doesn't exist, that has the ability to bring in services. The housing that you're talking about, we will say exists, or if I want to build a group home, this program isn't going to build a group home for me. There's another program out there that will construct a facility, but I might be able to tap into the service component to help the residents.
As a Medicaid waiver, like a home and community, they could, okay, somebody could build three individuals with disabilities could decide to live together in a home and bring their services in, and it wouldn't have to be licensed.
Yeah, but even if it were a 6-bed group home that were licensed, could I not access external services for my residents without that restriction? Because if I'm living in my own house, I'm eligible for services to come in and keep me living in my own house. So that's the distinction I'm trying to get where we're.
But Mike, when it's licensed, you may or may not be able to bring those services in from the outside, depending on what the license says.
Yeah, that's precisely, yeah.
So, I mean, the issue is here, does service-enriched housing include licensed facilities or not? And, I mean, my opinion is that we need to be very clear in this report that this does not include licensed facilities.
Well, if there are restrictions on what services can be brought in a licensed facility, then that's why you covered it in your definition, right? So with the opportunity to receive on-site or off-site, self-related
Yeah, it's more of a choice. When you're in a group home, you're buying into the service package. You're buying into that location.
So
and that service provider.
Right. So I think that what Marshall's saying is that haven't we already ruled out those type of licensed facilities that wouldn't allow that option then through our definition?
I thought we had.
Yeah, I thought we had too. Jim, you've been kind of quiet.
Well, I tend to agree. I mean, with your statement, Jonas, that if it's a licensed facility, it's not included in the definition.
Paige?
Ditto.
Okay. So I'm understanding the consensus to be that service-enriched housing, by our definition and by the work that will move forward, is it does not include licensed facilities.
Okay. I think you're right, and I don't know if we need to explain that we're not excluding it just because it has a license. The exclusion is based on that those facilities have their own programs for what we're trying to do outside.
And maybe more restrictions than our definition would allow.
Well, you know, I guess we do need to address it in some way in the report so it's clear what we're talking about.
Yes, and that's the point where I'm just trying. And actually, I think this has been a good conversation. I mean, I think it's been a necessary conversation to do this.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate you bringing it up, Mark, and I'm glad that we've had it and that we've made a decision. So we just need to make sure that we have a paragraph or a section in our biennial plan that addresses this issue so that the reader and the public is clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And for people who would be interested in developing service-rich housing, those people are very clear then how to direct their energy and their resources. So I appreciate the conversation. That's all I wanted to have here. And I think that adds a lot.
Okay. So I can certainly put that in this chapter do you think that it's best in this chapter? Do you think it's best to say it's right at the beginning in the preamble?
I think it's better in the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's better in the beginning.
No, absolutely. I think you need to stay up front.
Okay.
What we're doing.
Okay, I will make sure to put that language in the preamble, and I will, in terms of kind of moving on to research, staff research assignments, now that I think that we've discussed the Chapter 3 as much as we're going to today, Marshall and I, we will both make sure that we more fully flesh out the language that is going to be needed for this chapter, as well as create some type of draft for the preamble. And I can also make sure that I look into the public forum transcripts and flesh out a couple of profiles and bring those to our next conference call to see how we feel about those profiles. Is there anything additional for the staff for research assignments for this chapter moving forward? Further than what we already talked about.
Yeah, accessibility standards. Yeah.
Anything else?
Did we for the next step issue?
This was more the staff research assignments.
Okay.
So I know that there were a couple things mentioned during our discussion that will be further researched. I just wanted to make sure if there was anything additional to that discussion. Any research thoughts?
I don't have any.
Okay.
I think they pretty well fell out of the discussion.
Okay. All right. And then next steps for the committee. So our next meeting, as I had explained to everyone, 2 weeks from this Thursday is actually not a good day for many people. And so I wanted to move the conference call instead of being Thursday to Friday. And obviously, Jonas, as our chair, I don't want to leave you out. And you had expressed that the morning was not good for you on Friday.
It is not.
Okay. Does anyone have any objections to moving it to the afternoon?
That would actually be better for me because I should be off the road by then.
Okay. Paige?
Is it free?
Jane?
It's good for me. If it's a call-in, it's good. I can do that from anywhere.
Okay. So why don't we say, what do you want to say, 2 o'clock?
That's fine.
So, that's fine.
Okay. So we're going to say April 30th, right? 30th, yeah. Friday, April 30th, 2 p.m., and I believe we will probably try to, besides presenting the information, the research information to you and making sure that's all good to go, we'll probably be moving on to the chapter of identifying barriers, if that sounds like a good next step.
Sounds fine to me.
Works for me.
Good.
Ashley, I appreciate all of you and your colleagues' work there, and the way you've structured this is very good, and I think we're accomplishing a lot.
Good to hear, Janice. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Yeah. Thank you. All right. Well, then expect to get a email from me in the near future with the call-in number, participant code, and all that good stuff for the next meeting on the 30th.
All right, good. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, have a good day.
Bye. Bye.